The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
Well, good afternoon and greetings to you. Thanks for coming along today. This glorious, this perfection of a Thursday afternoon here on Pi Day, March 14th. Kath, good to see you.
Wearing a sundress and flip-flops.
Excellent.
I feel good about it.
Yeah, all the trees are ready to bloom, aren't they? You can see the buds on the trees ready to burst.
On my walk yesterday, I saw a bunch of daffodils who've made their entrance.
Yes,
now,
lovely.
Next week is probably going to be, an unwelcome bit of weather for them.
But we take it is right now, this moment.
Yes.
Which is beautiful,
right? You're right, and it is beautiful.
Glorious. Some 74 degrees right now. Yes. Any plans to celebrate Pi Day today?
No, but I like pi very much.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I appreciate the figure, but I much more prefer the dessert.
Yes.
Giving up sugar for Lent does take pi out of the equation.
Pizza pie.
Right.
Same thing. Still pie. When pie comes in
man,
all.
Man, am I glad we had this conversation.
Right, of course, yes. Comes in all shape. You and I are not exactly math heads.
You don't think.
We avoid that conversation.
Yes, we do.
With the math of 314 and the perfection of number, or the imperfection of numbers,
yes,
I should say.
Exactly.
Right?
Uh-huh.
But we can all enjoy a slice of pizza pie.
Yeah, I think you might have inspired me.
Thank you so much.
For goodness sake.
All right, what's going on with the show here?
Well, John, coming up on today's show, in the 5 o'clock hour, we're going to talk about a couple things that I think are interesting. One is, it's a Wall Street Journal piece that we really don't believe how much things cost.
No. Well, you take a quick drive around the grocery store. It's shocking.
Or around the car lot.
Oh, my gosh.
Or if you're looking on Zillow.
Yeah.
You can't believe how much things cost.
Right. I take a walk with my dog every day, and of course, you see the rare for sale signs on houses, because there's not a lot of houses for sale.
Right.
It's shocking in my neighborhood how much prices have escalated.
Listen, I took a friend out for dinner the other night to a burger bar place.
Yeah.
You know, our dinner was $60.
Mm-hmm. Pre-tip?
No, that would include the tip. $60.
Yeah, sure.
For two people.
Yeah.
This is not fine dining.
No, burgers.
This is not several courses. There's no dessert and there's no alcohol in that.
Although the other day, where were we? What was this all about? My wife and I, we were sort of stuck between things, and I was like, it's going to be a long time till we eat something. So I'm going to, this is the first time I've done this, I'm going to pull into McDonald's.
What?
I got a double cheeseburger, a fries, a small drink, and what did my wife, she got something as well. It was $10. We were like, oh, how can McDonald's make a profit on that?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a surprise.
I was surprised as well, yeah. So I guess you got to work hard to find your bargains.
More conversation about that coming up in the 5 o'clock hour. Also, we've got some celebrity birthdays to talk about today. We'll quiz you on that, John,
right,
and we'll talk again about Pi Day. And then coming up in the 4 o'clock hour, Frontier Airlines has a brand new option that you can pay more for. And of all the options I've seen on an aircraft, this might be my number one favorite.
Not wider seats, not more leg room. It's something else.
It's something else. And I'm looking forward to maybe taking advantage of that.
Very nice. There's all that and much more to come on the ride home. But before we get underway, Kath, let's look at the news stories. Please give us the top four at four.
For Thursday, March 14th, 2024, number one. Former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said he's putting together a consortium to try to buy TikTok. as a bid to separate the popular social media platform from its Chinese owners gathers some momentum in Congress. Reading here from today's Wall Street Journal, Mnuchin, who has long crusaded against Chinese ownership of the company, didn't specify how he might buy the business. It could be valued, John, at more than $100 billion. But his comments show that should there be a forced sale, interest would be high because there are 170 million users on the platform.
Good luck with that. Talk about expensive things.
I mean, the House yesterday voted to approve a bill that would ban it, ban TikTok, I mean, from web hosting services and app stores in the U.S. if the Chinese owner does not divest itself of the business. The bill, though, still needs to be blessed by the Senate. Senators seem to be more cautious about this approach. There's a lot to think about with a former Treasury Secretary buying a business and potentially benefiting from laws that were passed. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things to think
about. Oh, sure. The wolves are lined up.
Anyway, read more about that at the Journal today. Number two, hundreds of victims of child sexual abuse by priests or church representatives have received financial compensation in France's Catholic Church under a sweeping reparations program, an independent body in charge of the process announced today. An annual report by the Independent National Authority for Recognition and Reparation said 1,351 victims came forward to claim compensation and seek psychological support in an effort to recover from childhood trauma. The average age of victims who have come forward is 61. Of them, 66% are men, 34% are women. The claims process started a couple years ago. So far, the Reparations Authority has approved compensation claims of 489 victims.
Good.
Read more about that at ABC News. Number three. If you're one of the thousands of people that were planning on going to the Pens game tonight to get your Jaromir Jagr bobblehead, I'm sorry to tell you, they're gone. Mm. Yes, it's not that somebody came and gobbled them all up and is going to give them to happy Penguins fan. No, they've been stolen. In a news release, the Pens said they learned they were victims of cargo theft after failing to receive the shipment as scheduled. If you are one of the people that has a ticket tonight, you will receive a one-time scannable barcode that will be required to pick up your bobblehead at a later date. Team officials said it's an open investigation. No further comment would be made. Mm-hmm.
Some wit on Twitter said this is the beginning plot of Sudden Death 2.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's really funny. It all started with the Jagr bobblehead theft. That's from the Trib. And number four, as John said, today's National Pi Day.
Woo-hoo.
Represented in abbreviated form by the 3.1416, or of course the Greek letter pi, it's actually a ratio which denotes the relationship between the circumference and the diameter of a circle. That's your top four. At four.
I would prefer coconut cream, apple, cherry, anything of that order. Right.
Okay, but can I tell you something cool?
Please. Whip.
So, in reading the article today, and I read from, let's see, I think this is AP. No, this is CBS. We know that pi is a constant. It doesn't matter if you're measuring the circumference and diameter of a cell or of the Earth or of something like Jupiter.
It stays the same.
It stays the same. So it's amazing that it stays the same. There was a person by the name of Manil Sori, who's a mathematics and stats professor at the University of Maryland. And he was quoted today, and this is what he said. It's quite amazing there's such a constant that's true for all circles. That's what really gets me. Draw any circle, and the circumference divided by the diameter will always be the same number. It's a little chilling, in a way, he said. I think symbolically it just shows that there are certain laws the universe follows, and these are mathematical. And for me as a mathematician, that's key. So whether we measure it in feet or meters or whatever, or whether we exist or not, that number will always be the same. It's really kind of amazing.
That's the mind of God.
That is.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
The same.
It's incredible.
Yesterday, today,
incredible.
And always. We'll take a quick break, step away. We're going to talk about another constant in this world, whether you engage or not. Visible grace, learning to see the church as Jesus does. That's straight ahead. We're Pittsburgh's Christian Talk. It's The Ride Home here on 101.5 Word FM, WORD. For a lot of people, of course, grace is too good to be true, mm-hmm. because it doesn't make any sense at all, right? We live this way in our own sinfulness, our own destruction, our own despair, our own ugliness. And still, God's grace covers all of us. Caleb Batzler is back with us. He is Youth and Families Minister at Desert Springs Church in Albuquerque, New Mexico. His brand new work is called Visible Grace, Learning to See the Church as Jesus Does. Caleb, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John, Kathy, thanks again for having me. A lot's changed since the last time we talked. I'm actually down in Boynton Beach, Florida now.
What?
Serving at a church there. So, yeah, just move a couple thousand miles east of Albuquerque, and that's where we are now.
Well, it's time for us to update our bio.
That's right.
New Mexico's in the rearview mirror, Caleb.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's the old Caleb.
Yeah.
Just created a different kind of heat, the desert heat for the hot and humid heat.
Oh, sure.
In South Florida.
But grace is the same, whether you're New Mexico or Florida, yeah?
Amen. Yeah.
Caleb, let me start with this. I was praying for a friend this morning who's going through just a really, really, really hard time. And as I was praying for her, I was all of a sudden just overwhelmed at the number of things I could even name that were just graces of God in my life. I mean, people, relationships, circumstance, you name it, just one thing after another. So I finally had to stop because someone came up to talk to me. I was in a public place when I was doing this. Because it's God's grace is so personal to me because I see that in such specific ways in my life. But when we talk about grace, I think we often talk about it as that it's kind of like we would talk about cloud cover. Like it's just kind of all over it's all over everybody and kind of impersonal.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, kind of like Skittles in a vending machine. You just like pop in the code and out pops grace.
Yeah.
Right. But go deeper into that. What exactly, if you were talking to someone uninitiated with the idea of grace, what is grace?
Yeah, so the way I define grace, and I can get into the letter to the church in Ephesus in a little bit, but the simple definition that I've come up with that's helpful for me is not Bible. If you guys don't like it, you can push back on it. But I define grace as the personal love of God for people who deserve the eternal wrath of God. Mm-hmm. So I'm drawing that hopefully from all of Scripture, but I see that a lot in Ephesians. You notice when grace comes up in Paul's letter to the church in Ephesus, when he talks about grace, he doesn't speak about it in an impersonal way. It's always connected to the Trinity. So you see the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit showing up whenever grace is showing up. So when God's grace comes to believers, he's not just throwing down something that's impersonal. But he comes as himself. God the Son himself comes. And so grace coming to us is really God coming to us.
Then what about non-believers, Caleb? I mean, for people who receive grace, unbeknownst to them, is that a thing, right? They would say, well, I was just fortunate, or, you know, that was lucky, or, you know, I got a gift.
Yeah. I mean, believers are going to experience the personal nature of grace at a level that unbelievers never will be able to, because when someone trusts in Christ for salvation, they get God dwelling in them. So grace comes in and just embodies, grace comes into believers and dwells with them. Unbelievers, they are also experiencing a personal nature of grace as God is kind to them. He sends the rain on the just and the unjust, and he's the one who does that. So they are rejecting a person when they're rejecting grace. It's not just a thing, but they don't get to experience the personal nature of it like believers would be able to. Do you agree? Would you have anything to add there?
I mean, I don't. I mean, both of us probably, and all our listeners probably have something to add to that. But, you know, I think that that's right at its core. And I think that sometimes, depending on what denominational background you're from, people tend to define grace as purely a theological term. without really engaging with it in personal life.
Even though we've all experienced
it. Yeah, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't have a theological weight. And it does, you know, but it seems oftentimes in conversation like it's transactional almost. That God gives us grace when we deserve death, which is true. But seeing that grace in a personal sense is what makes me love God. I mean, it's you know what I mean? It's a much more emotional thing. And I think it should be than we often talk about it as.
I totally agree. Yeah, that's good.
And oftentimes when I experience grace, I know how unworthy I am.
Yes.
And it goes back to the humility and bowing before God and his majesty and the gratitude within all that. So it's kind of like a circle, right? That it just continually moves through my life. And I need and want and all that. So if I didn't know the concept of grace, all that would disappear from my life in some way.
Amen.
We're talking to Caleb Batchelor. His new book is called Visible Grace, Learning to See the Church as Jesus Does. So let's talk about the church. You know, we just talked about a news story today that there are, I don't know, somewhere around 2,000 people in France who have submitted a claim for sexual abuse suffering that was visited upon them by members of the Roman Catholic Church in the last 40 or 50 years. And so that's a story that gains a lot of prominence in media because it's another story of the church being terrible, really being really not just preying upon its victims, but even more significantly being a completely wretched witness for Jesus in the world, the opposite of that, in fact. Yeah. So can you talk about how different people see the church and what grace means in that?
Yeah. Well, I think one thing in this whole concept of looking for grace in the church is you have to be able to recognize whether a group is actually a true church or whether they're just claiming a church. So you look at the letter to the church in Galatia. You see, Paul, he addresses a false doctrine as being something that needs to be corrected. And he also corrects Peter, because I opposed Peter to his face, because his life wasn't matching up with the gospel. And so you see there's the correction of doctrine and sometimes of practice. And so I would say there's some people who would claim the name of Christ that if their lives are not actually matching up with what it means to be a follower of Jesus, then perhaps that they actually aren't a true church, sadly, which may be some of the instances that, you know, come to some people's minds or their bad experiences with the church.
Yes.
But with churches that are, you know, struggling, but are preaching a true gospel and by God's grace are seeking to follow after to Jesus, the call of that I've been seeking to give myself and really kind of the purpose of this book is that when we look at those churches, true churches, that when Jesus sees them, he sees them as the new creation that they are. They're going to be sinful. There's going to be lots of frustrating things in them, but that's not their identity. Their identity is Jesus. And since grace is personal, when Jesus sees them, he sees a reflection of the Trinity in them, and that's their identity. And he sees the sin, and he's grieved by sin. He doesn't minimize sin at all, but he sees the true nature of these believers. And what I'm desiring is that would be the first thing that I would spot to you. So I'm talking a lot, but I guess you're having me on your show. So,
it's your job, yeah.
When I think about my natural inclination, whenever I think of how God views me, is I kind of see him, when he looks for grace in Caleb Batchelor's life, I view him as trying to, like, find a needle in a haystack. Like, grace is there, just, like, somewhere, but he has to really go looking for it. And mainly what gets his attention is all of the sin. Or perhaps it would be like trying to find Waldo, like stuff like Waldo's like somewhere on the page, like grace is somewhere, but like it's sure hard to see it. And apart from the gospel, I mean that makes sense. But because of the gospel, because of what Jesus has done for us and the Spirit working in us, Father's love for us, when Jesus sees us, it's less like spotting finding a needle in a haystack, and more like spotting the sunrise in the dark sky. You know, there's all this dark sky that's filling up the expanse of the heavens. But what does our minds go to when just that little glimmer of the sun starts to come up? Well, it doesn't go to the majority of what the sky looks like. No, that zeroes in on the beauty of the sun rising. And the reality is, like, that's the new creation dawning in our lives. And so when God sees us, he sees that little bit of grace, and it was like, oh, it's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And eventually the sun is just going to fill up the whole sky.
Fabulous. We're talking with Caleb Batchelor. He's got a brand new work called Visible Grace, Learning to See the Church as Jesus Does. Caleb, my guess is, you know, you've been attending church for a long time. You've worked at multiple churches. We know that from our introduction to you. And would it be that the church itself was the vision in perfection that Christ, you know, has cast for us all, that there was grace in all that? But oftentimes, you know, the church, and you know this, we all do, if you're part of a church, the church is just a reflection of society in many ways, where there is anger and resentment and all the backbiting, you know, that is what we are of what it is to be alive. And would it be that we had true grace in our lives, that we would talk together, pray together, eat together, worship together in some perfection? I mean, that is set before us, but it's hard to maintain that or even create that in a very small sample of what it is the local church, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we are not in heaven, are we?
No.
but we get little glimpses of it. You know, I mean, I've seen it, and I'm sure you guys have. I'd love to even hear, perhaps maybe I could turn it back on your side, of just ways you've seen kind of the future heavenly reality of a totally unified, glorious church. How you've seen that in your own churches. I mean, just, I'm sure you've seen in the churches you guys are a part of, God's grace there, even in the midst of the disagreement. I'm sure you've seen God's grace in churches that you probably disagree with doctrinally even. Right? You guys have seen that.
Without a doubt, you see it. I mean, and as is always is, more often than not, you see it a little too late. I mean, I just recently attended a funeral service for someone who was a giant in our church, and one person after another stood up and proclaimed, this man loved Jesus. He knew the gospel of Christ. He engaged, he equipped, you know, he brought so many people into Jesus through his works of evangelism. There was this huge celebration. It was lovely. I mean, you were just immersed in great love. But, of course, while the day-to-day is going on, like I said, you know, earlier, we tend to split and point the finger, and we fall far short of that grace. It's much more after the fact, so to speak.
Not with Paul, though, right?
No.
Not with Paul. First Corinthians. I mean, it's hard to get – you can't even get a few lines into his letters to the church at Corinth, which was messed up in so many ways. I mean, they were just like a hot mess. And how did he start his letter to the church at Corinth? To the church of God that is in Corinth, to those sanctified in Christ Jesus, called to be saints, together with all those who are in every place, on the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, both their Lord and ours, grace to you and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. And he gives thanks for him. He says, I give thanks to my God always for you because of the grace of God that was given you in Christ Jesus.
Amen to that.
We've been talking to Caleb Batchelor live from Boynton Beach, Florida. His brand new book is called Visible Grace, Learning to See the Church as Jesus Does. Thanks, Caleb.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah.
Take a quick break. Step away. We've got more ahead. Frontier Airlines.
I've got my new option. Very nice. I'm going to be voting for on my next airline trip.
Frontier Airlines has announced a new seating option that will provide customers with extra space and comfort during flights. They're called Upfront Plus Seats, which are in the front of the plane, obviously. Customers in those seats will get a guaranteed window or aisle seat with extra legroom and an empty middle seat.
Oh my gosh, bring it. Would that be luxury?
Fabulous. Frontier customers can now upgrade to Upfront Plus seating for flights departing on or after April the 10th, starting at $49 per seat. The upgrades will only be available through April 30th. So it's only like, it's a little
right, more
brief
than
tease. Space on flights or lack thereof has long been a point of pain for travelers. Of course, isn't it for everybody if you're on a plane? You want more space. How about when the doors close and you've got an empty seat between you and the guy on the other side?
You feel like you won the lottery.
Exactly.
I'm serious.
Especially
if you're on a long flight.
Yep. And the countdown to it is like, please don't anybody come in. Please don't anybody sit here. Please. $45. Listen, Frontier comes with a checkered history, doesn't it?
I don't remember that.
Have you ever flown Frontier?
No, I never have.
Mm-hmm. Well,
is there a reason why I've never flown?
I don't want to disparage them on air.
Right.
But I'm just saying, because, you know, the discount carriers all have, you get what you pay for in a way.
Right. Well, that's what I'm thinking. $49 almost, I mean, you know, I love a bargain.
Yeah.
But that almost seems too cheap.
People's Airlines.
People's
29
Airlines.
Bucks.
Right.
Pittsburgh to New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the gift of the century.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. The idea of just a little extra space, personal space, because if you're stuck in the middle, if you got somebody in the middle, that sort of battle for the elbow, I just tend to sort of surrender that to the person.
Yeah, right.
If you're on either side of the seat,
it's just you're not going to have that fight.
That person in the middle, God bless
you. Know what I hate the most, though, out of anything, is being in the back seat, the very last row that doesn't recline.
Oh, fight against that.
I hate that. I hate
that. For a number of reasons.
Oh, exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
There's the line for the bathroom.
Listen, I flew from Chicago to Tokyo.
In the back seat?
I was supposed to be in the back seat, and the person didn't show up who was in the seat in front of me, and I got to move up.
Whew.
I would have been... I don't remember how many. That's 15 hours, I think, or 16 hours or something.
Talk about grace.
Oh.
Unmerited favor.
Okay, if you had to pick between window and aisle, what do you pick?
I generally choose window.
Okay.
Because a window, for me, you just kind of create your own bubble.
Yeah.
You can lean against the wall if there's anything like there. Plus, if it's a daylight flight, you get a little view.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you got to go to the men's room or whatnot, you just make your apologies and do it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like your own domain for me.
Okay.
Where the aisle is kind of busy, your knees sticking out, you want to claim that space, but you really can't. I get why people want the aisle, but I don't mind like my own little space.
Yeah, I understand
that's
that.
All.
I understand that.
You?
I'm big time aisle.
Are you?
Yep. I'm big time aisle. I just like to be able to turn my head to the left or right and just be not 6 inches from somebody.
Peruse everybody else.
I like to be able to get up, especially like I said, if I'm taking a long flight, I need to be able to walk around. I need to be able to do, you know, whatever exercise I can. I hate that. Boxed in feeling.
Yeah. I mean, the long flight, I mean, you know, those long flights, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 plus hours. I think all rules are kind of off on those flights.
Because everybody just has to survive.
You're like, you know, in steerage class on the Titanic.
And you are.
Like, give me some air. Give me a view.
And
give
the
me a
size
little...
of those planes is, I've never been on a plane as big as that plane.
It's a miracle.
It is a miracle.
It really
is an absolute miracle.
That they can even get off.
Yes.
All right. So thanks to Frontier. Pay you that $49 for that extra seat in the middle.
All right. Coming up next, Liturgy in the Wilderness. Have you ever thought about how the Lord's Prayer might shape your imagination? We'll talk about it next. Thursday edition. It's The Ride Home. In my denomination, the Lord's Prayer isn't something, or at least the service I go to, the Lord's Prayer isn't something that we pray as a community every week. But it's always something that we pray monthly when we have communion. And it's never been part of my daily practice either. But this is what I find frustrating is when I'm not saying there's no value in stating it together as a body of faith or praying it together.
Our Father.
But it's so full and deep to me that I need a lot of time between each phrase for me to really pray it from my heart.
Right.
You know, our Father is so
gigantic.
Incredible. I mean, but you can break it down everywhere. So I have a very hard time whenever we pray it as a community. I oftentimes don't because I feel like my mind can't get around it and it would just be, it wouldn't be honest.
It's funny you say that. I'm sure for me, as a parochial schoolboy, it was the first prayer that I learned by memory.
Yeah.
And so it trips off my tongue easily.
Yeah.
but I do know, like yourself, by giving it short shrift and just, you know, blowing through it, so to speak, right? I do it a huge disservice, right?
Or at least I do God a disservice, or me, or yeah. I don't even know. It's a complicated thing. We're happy to have DJ Murata with us today, Anglican priest, the founder of Redeemer Anglican in Richmond, Virginia, and the author of the brand new book, Liturgy in the Wilderness, How the Lord's Prayer Shapes the Imagination of the Church in a Secular Age. Dan, welcome in.
Thank you for having me on. Good to be talking together.
Our pleasure, Dan. So, Liturgy in the Wilderness. I mean, when I first saw this title, I thought, this is someone who's praying outside.
Yes, it can feel that way. And actually, for that very reason, we didn't put mountains on the cover.
Right.
Okay.
But still,
this
I went
is
there.
Really going to throw people off.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so what wilderness are you thinking of?
Yes. Okay, so hang with me. The people of Israel, they're enslaved in Egypt. God comes to them through his servant Moses. There's this, you know, confrontation with Pharaoh. He sets them free. He takes them through the waters of the Red Sea. They go to Mount Sinai. They get the law. They learn how to be God's people, and they're on their way to the promised land. But what comes first? The wilderness, right? Now, that narrative arc really does map onto the narrative arc for any Christian today. You're there in your sin. You're enslaved to sin. God comes to you. In Jesus, he sets you free from slavery to sin. He takes you through the waters of baptism, kind of like through the waters of the Red Sea. You're getting discipled. You're learning God's law. You're learning how to live as his follower. And you're on your way to that new creation, God's promised land. But what comes first?
The wilderness.
The wilderness. Hmm. And so the idea is, so often I think we as Americans use the word wilderness to mean like, oh, I'm going through a hard time in life, right? Like I'm in a wilderness season. And I'm not shaming or putting anybody down for using the word wilderness that way. That certainly makes a lot of sense. However, that's not the way the Bible uses the word wilderness. The wilderness is the place where God meets you in between setting you free and the promised land, your ultimate destination. So our lives are lived in the wilderness. We'll always be in the wilderness as long as we're in this life.
That's really good. So then that expression, that image you just painted, it fuels our imagination, right? Because everybody has their own view of themselves in the wilderness, what that looks like or feels like or sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so here's how it changed things for me. When I realized this, it changed the way I prayed. Because up until that point, and honestly, I would confess to you, still some days, my prayers are mostly get me out of the wilderness kind of prayers, right?
Right.
Things are bad and I don't like it and I want God's help. And that's not, it's not wrong to pray that way.
No.
But the Lord's Prayer is a wilderness prayer, meaning it's how you meet with God while you're in the wilderness when you're not asking to get out of the wilderness.
Hmm. So then what is it about the construct and the theology and the grace and all that about the Lord's Prayer that is in the wilderness but keeps us there?
Mm-hmm. So I was listening to what the two of you were saying earlier, and I loved it. You were describing how there's so much packed into the Lord's Prayer that you don't want to rush through it because there's just so much there, and that's absolutely right. Sometimes I like to say, the Lord's Prayer is sort of like the wardrobe that leads into Narnia. Mm. It's bigger on the inside than it appears to be on the outside.
Like the TARDIS.
Are you
a Doctor Who fan?
No. Well, I was referencing C.S. Lewis
in the
Chronicles of Narnia. Yeah. And so it's kind of like the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed. Like there's so much richness packed in there that it does us well to slow down and to pay attention to every word and phrase, because each one will go to work on our imaginations.
So why do we then? I mean, like, you know, Catholic experience is unlike my experience, but there is a crossroads there. It's so deep and so rich, but at the same time, it's so familiar that we often just kind of, I don't want to minimize it, but, you know, we neglect it or we give it a good meh.
Mm-hmm. It's like a treasure hidden in plain sight. We're so overly familiar with it that it's easy to just go into autopilot, just make your mouth, say the words, don't think about it, move on, right?
Yeah.
And so part of the reason for writing the book was just by writing a book and inviting people to read it, to invite people to slow down, and to pay attention to what these words really mean and what Jesus might be up to when he answers that really normal question the disciples ask him. The disciples come to Jesus and say, Lord, teach us to pray. Really normal thing for any first century disciple to ask their Jewish rabbi. And Jesus doesn't give them what they asked for, at least not exactly. They probably wanted a formula, some sort of like, hey, how do we get God's attention and get him to say yes to our prayers? And instead, Jesus gives them this very short liturgy. When you pray, say, Our Father, and off the prayer goes. And what he's doing is some subversive work where as the disciples pray this day over day, week over week, month over month, this prayer is going to go to work on them. It's going to change them. And they might have realizations and discoveries and epiphanies like months or years down the road as they pray this prayer when they realize what they're actually saying and what those words mean.
Yeah. There were many years in my own life, Dan, where I thought that rote prayers were a total waste of time. And not even
me too.
And is that right? Okay, so not Absolutely. Even a total waste of time. I thought that they were unimaginative and
lazy.
Lazy, exactly.
Until
we met Frederica Matthews Green, who is an Orthodox writer, and she introduced us. She wrote a book on the Jesus Prayer, which we read probably 14 years ago. Yep. John and I did both read it. And I was like, well, this is crazy. You know. And but the more I read it, I thought, now wait, clearly I haven't given this a shot. And then by the end, I kind of wanted to, but then I was afraid because I was like, is this weird? Like, am I stepping out into, because to me, I was stepping out into weird theological maybe it was just practice, but it was weird territory for me.
But see, Dan, I grew up with rote prayer. And so I love the poetry and the beauty and the intensity and the structure of it all. I don't think it's cheating. I think it's an aid.
So do I now. And so I think I appreciate what you're saying about the Lord's Prayer in a way that I wouldn't have a decade. Yeah, a decade ago. Can you talk about how you feel about rote prayer? You said you kind of grew up like I did.
Yeah. So I would want to say to any listeners, if you're the kind of person who, you know, just the idea of praying using someone else's words sounds strange, or maybe even you might even go so far as to say wrong, like inauthentic. I would want to say first and foremost, I empathize. I understand. I have been in that place. I deeply desire authenticity and integrity in my life with God and in my prayer life. And so for those reasons, I was very skeptical of liturgical prayers. How could I use someone else's words when what I really want is an authentic and deep heart connection with God? And what I found over the years was that learning to pray is a lot like learning to speak any language. And how do children learn how to speak? Well, they learn how to speak by repeating the words that they hear other people saying, right?
Yeah, imitation.
No kid. Yeah, imitation, exactly. And so, you know, the mom or dad leans over the crib and says, you know, can you say daddy? Can you say mommy? And they're hoping the kid responds. And as the kid listens and as the kid tries this out, eventually they learn how to talk. And then eventually they are able to just kind of speak fluidly and express their own thoughts and desires and to other people. But they don't start that way. And the problem is that when it comes to prayer, we're asking people to start with fluency. And I think that does people a great disservice. And I think it's why so many people they don't like praying. They don't experience God during prayer because they've spent their whole lives trying to start with fluency. It didn't work. And now they're not interested anymore. And what I love doing in ministry is taking people back to the basics and go, when the disciples wanted to learn how to pray, they went to Jesus. And that's, of course, the right place to go. Go to Jesus with your question. And Jesus gave the disciples an answer, and what he gave them was a very short liturgy. If you want to learn how to pray, here's where to start. And invite people to begin thinking of prayer as a learned language. This is something that's going to take practice. There's going to be a long apprenticeship. It takes kids years to learn how to speak, and we shouldn't think that we're going to learn how to pray any faster.
That's so good. Dan Marotta is with us. He's an Anglican priest, the founder of Redeemer Anglican Church in Richmond, Virginia, author of Liturgy in the Wilderness. We're talking about that right now. Dan, what about, you know, in this crazy time we're living in where we are distracted to death, right, with our phones and whatnot, it's rare for most of us, maybe not, maybe just me, that we sit in silence and there's nothing behind us and hopefully nothing before us. And before we go into prayer, we just sit in that space, that emptiness. I mean, it's as odd and maybe perhaps as terrifying as it is, before you launch into the words, "Our Father," that's the springboard for all relation and all connection with Jesus.
Wait, you're saying that that's a common practice?
I think for me it is.
Okay, that is. I do not think that is remotely a common practice.
What, to sit there?
I think that's a great idea. I think that's a wonderful practice, but I think that's uncommon.
Before you pray, isn't there a... has to be a time.
Well, I think for a lot of people there isn't. And if you go in your church, is there ever a time?
Of silence? Mm-hmm.
Before you pray? Not often.
I need it.
I do too.
Dan?
Weigh in.
I do. I'm just laughing listening to the two of you because, oh my goodness, I'm right there with you. John, I have cultivated that practice over the years, but oh my goodness, I did not start there. I started right where, with what Kathy is describing, which is my life is noisy, I'm distracted, I've always got screens in front of me. And then I might take a minute to try to pray, and it hardly ever goes well, largely because I'm still so noisy on the inside.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even if I've gotten my body to be still and quiet on the outside.
Dan Murata, he's a priest, the founder of Redeemer Anglican Church in Richmond, Virginia. His brand new work is called Liturgy in the Wilderness, How the Lord's Prayer Shapes the Imagination of the Church in a Secular Age. Chuck Norris once roundhouse kicked someone so hard that his foot broke the speed of light. That's a Chuck Norris factoid.
Right.
And of course, if you've had boys in your life, you at one point were surrounded by all these factoids because the original bad boy, dating back to the 1960s, Chuck Norris, well, this past Sunday, he turned 84.
No way.
So Chuck Norris says even he is defeating death. Well, we'll find out about that. But Chuck Norris, in a video that he posted on Sunday, he says, I'm high-energy boxing on my 84th birthday. I feel like I'm 48 years old. He looks fabulous.
Does he really?
Yeah, he really does. I mean, seriously.
Okay, show me.
He's been around a long, long time.
Okay, he does look terrific.
Yeah. There he is somewhere in the wilds
of
California.
He's 84.
He's 84.
Okay, so looking at him, he could be 65.
Yeah, I think so. Whether he's had work done or not.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Why would you have work done if you're a... I mean, I hate to say that
Hollywood.
If you're a guy.
You live in Hollywood.
Yeah, I guess.
Right? It's, you know, the same kind of throw, right?
I guess.
But Chuck Norris. Any connection at all to Chuck Norris?
No, I've never seen a Chuck Norris movie. No, I never have.
Never seen Walker Ranger?
Nothing.
Really?
Mm-mm.
No connection at
no,
all?
No, but, you know, growing up in the 80s like I did, everybody knew who Chuck Norris was.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Everybody knows who he is. Who was, you know, he was around my age.
Almost sort of supersedes the culture, right?
Yes. You don't have to, like, like I said, I've never seen him in a film. Of course
but you knew
who he
was.
Yeah.
That's so weird, isn't
it? In my head, though, he was kind of frozen at the age of 60.
Yeah, right. Walker Ranger.
Yes.
Right?
Is that what? Walker, Texas Ranger.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It's on CBS, I believe.
Did you watch that?
Not really.
No.
You know, maybe walking through the room or something. I don't know. Not really. But, you know, anyway, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
The original bad guy, Chuck Norris.
Welcome to another edition of The Ride Home with John and Kathy, live from the Salem-Pittsburgh studios. And now here are your hosts, John Hall and Kathy Emmons.
You know that there is a pie dedicated to pie? Or should we say P-I? A pie, P-I-E.
Oh, there's a P-I-E dedicated to the P-I?
That's right.
Okay.
Today marks the annual Pi Day, a day dedicated to honoring the mathematical constant pi aka 3-14. Uh-huh. The day is also just a great excuse to bake up your favorite pie recipe, so it's no wonder that Google uses Pie Day as an opportunity to discover what pies people are searching for the most across the country. Okay? I'll break it down. In the month before Pie Day 2024, people across the country were seeking out savory pie recipes more than any other type of pie.
Savory more than any other type of pie. That's a surprise.
That includes Frito chili pie.
Okay. You know that would be delicious.
Heck yeah, it would be, right? Followed by fruit pies, chocolate pies, or nutty pies. And among the states that have searched for custard pies, you'll see springtime pies, lemon meringue pie in North Dakota, and Vermont, along with lemon icebox pie in Arkansas and Mississippi. But there are other custard pies, too. Coconut cream pie was a
personal
popular
favorite
search.
Of yours.
Nebraska and West Virginia, their favorite pies. So a list of pies state by state.
Okay, now I'm going to hazard a guess about Pennsylvania. Have you gotten to Pennsylvania yet?
I have not.
Okay,
no,
can you
no.
get there, or is that an inconvenient navigation for you?
I'm not sure if I can see this. What is your holding about the perfect pie for Pennsylvania?
Well, first of all, my favorite pie is lemon meringue.
Is it?
And it has to come from Eaton Park.
Okay.
I'm sorry. That's just how I feel about it. A close second, I would have the chocolate cream pie from the Pie Place. Look, and my alarm's going off because it's time for pie. I love the chocolate cream pie from the Pie Place.
Okay, but this is weird. Now, this is Google, of course, which comes with its own weirdness. So, according to Google, the favorite pie in Pennsylvania...
Wait, is pecan.
No.
Then I don't know.
The Italian Easter pie.
What's Italian Easter pie?
What is the Italian Easter pie? We're supposed to know this in Pennsylvania.
Lexi's looking at me like she doesn't know.
The Italian Easter pie.
I've never heard of the Italian Easter pie. Mm-hmm.
I'm the local Italian and I don't know.
That's why I'm looking at you.
Italian Easter pie, right? I have no idea what that is.
Is that a lasagna? Is that another term for it?
Italian Easter pie. All right. I mean, because they list, Google does all these other, like in Maine, their favorite pie is the cottage pie. Have you ever heard of the cottage pie? The French meat pie in Rhode Island.
The
ricotta pie
the
in
French
New Hampshire.
Meat pie?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So a lot of these, I would guess that this is Google just being Google or AI being AI.
I mean, that's silly.
Right? In Florida, the favorite pie is something called the Aldo pie.
Oh, it's an Italian meat pie, Lexi says, going back to the Italian. Okay. The Italian Easter pie is cheesy and meaty ricotta filling.
Well, I'd like to have that.
Well, yeah, but if it's the most popular pie in Pennsylvania, how could we not know about that?
Maybe like one little tiny corner of Philadelphia or something like that, right? That's what I would imagine.
I mean, there are a lot of Italians here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you'd think that. Anybody Italian want to give us a call?
I liked my thought that maybe it was just another word for lasagna.
It's probably closer to that, right?
Yeah.
The Italian meat pie. But so how about this? In Michigan, the spaghetti pie.
This is made up.
I think it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I went to Michigan every year of my life for about, I don't know, 15 years.
I never had a spaghetti pie. How about the French silk pie?
Well, that's delicious. Mm-hmm. That's a chocolate pie.
French silk pie?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
That's very good.
Strawberry cream pie? I've never had a strawberry cream pie.
Listen, I like a strawberry cream pie if it has a layer of dark chocolate in it.
Really?
Which is it's not standard, but that really kicks
it
up.
Okay, West Virginia, our neighbors to the south, their favorite apparently is a coconut cream pie, but Virginia is the vinegar pie.
Which is fabulous. And you can buy a butter joint here in Pittsburgh. And it's one of my most favorite desserts.
Interesting. All right. Lex, any confirmation there on the Italian Easter pie? You got anything there deeper for us?
Not at all.
Nothing.
I have nothing.
Come up empty.
I've never heard of that in my life. I had to Google it and just
Italian
read.
And as a local
Easter
Italian,
pie.
I mean, yeah. It's heartbreaking for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it puts me to shame, honestly.
I mean, there has to be some Italians out there who enjoy this because, I mean, if it's the pie... Okay, now, Kathy, you're a big fan of Eaton Park pie. And all your years?
Never.
Of course not.
Of course not. But you can always get a Dutch apple. You can get a very nice coconut cream.
Fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think.
Anyway, happy pie day.
Happy pie day to everybody.
Short of the Italian Easter pie, yeah. Whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. Or the I kind of like the idea of a spaghetti pie, right?
Do you?
Yeah, heck yeah. I'd try that. Yes.
Is it hot or is it cold?
I don't know. It's spaghetti. You can eat spaghetti cold or hot.
Yeah,
right?
I know, but I don't think. Right? I don't think.
Short of that, though, I'll do lasagna.
Me. Okay.
Do you ever make lasagna?
I love it, but it's a lot of work.
My sister makes a great lasagna.
It's such, shoot. You just have to really commit. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it has to be when I'm not working anymore because it's just a long-term
it's
investment.
It's a days-long process, isn't
right.
it?
I have right. 1 day a week off, and I don't think I want to spend that day making lasagna.
No, especially now that the weather's changed.
Forget it.
Right. Okay, we will take a quick break. And Jesus Juke, have you ever heard the expression?
Never.
On the impulse to Jesus Juke, Bonnie Christian will join us next. Stick around.
Bonnie Christian is back with us, columnist at Christianity Today and deputy editor at The Week. Bonnie, we're glad you're here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. So, Bonnie, one of the perils of being a writer, right, is that as you write, you include, and perhaps I should say, indict those around you. Now, your latest piece, in some ways, indicts your mother.
Well, I hope she didn't read it that way, but the article was for my Substack. And it's about the idea of the Jesus juke, which is a term that's not original to me. My understanding is that the word juke, and that's J-U-K-E, like joke, but with a different vowel, comes from sports, which is not my area of expertise. But the idea essentially is something that Christians will do sometimes where you're talking about something that has nothing to do with faith, doesn't seem like a very serious topic, and suddenly someone will swoop in, bringing up Jesus or bringing up some aspect of spirituality or the Bible, something like that. And so, you know, an example that's not original to me is one person says, I can't believe I spent 6 hours watching that TV show. And the other person says, what if you'd spent 6 hours in prayer instead?
Oh.
And so, right. You know, it's kind of just like, did you have to bring that up? It can make you feel as, you know, as the other person in the conversation sort of inferior, like the other person is more spiritual than you.
Yeah.
It often doesn't land very well.
Yeah. But, you know, what I loved about it, you know, you talk about your mom, where something as simple as butter, your mom would be able to make, the topic of butter go to Jesus. I mean, that's genius.
It is remarkable. And I sometimes I find it kind of frustrating. I don't often know how to respond when the conversation takes that sudden pivot because it's not where my brain is going at all. You know, I'm just trying to deal with the immediate, often very practical and mundane matter at hand.
Yeah.
But yeah, she is the queen of it. She can turn any conversation that way on a dime.
I mean, your last name is Christian. I mean, that's the ultimate Jesus juke, you said, right?
Yeah. It's my mom changed her name before I was born. And yes, my last name is Christian. And yes, it is like the religion, as I often have to tell people, it is about Jesus.
She specifically changed her name to Christian. I mean, that's to me is like the ultimate Jesus juke.
Yeah.
I love it.
Wow. Okay, Bonnie, so can you talk about the impetus for such a thing? Like, what drives the person who does this?
You know, I don't know, having never done it at that level myself, I think that there are two different ways to sort of receive it, though, right? Sometimes it, like I said, it really doesn't land well. It feels like the other person is trying to spiritualize something that perhaps doesn't need to be spiritualized or trying to suggest that they think about Jesus more than you do, and that can be quite frustrating. And, you know, I think sometimes people do it in a way that perhaps warrants that kind of interpretation. But a lot of times, and I think certainly this is the case with my mom, it's just very much the result of like a long years of faithfulness, and that is where the mind naturally turns. And so, you know, something I asked in the piece, like, you know, is it something that I should be avoiding, or is it something that I should sort of envy and wish that my mind so easily turns to Jesus in apparently unrelated situations?
Right. I mean, I think it's really interesting. I love it because people who do this, it's like talking about your love, like your infatuation. Everything comes back to that, and you can't help it. It just precedes it, you know, everything in your life. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think in sort of the best case scenario, and I've known many people who do think and talk this way, that is what it flows out of. And that doesn't necessarily make it any easier.
No.
You might still feel caught off guard when it happens. But understanding that that is the motivation can make a big difference.
So on the negative side, Bonnie, it can come off like kind of the same way. Oh, all he does is talk about his girlfriend. You know, when you have a friend who does that and you think, oh, my gosh, is there nothing else, you know, in your life? Now you think, well, it's God. So, you know, there can't be too much God in your life. But but there's that weird language thing where you, depending on how you talk about God, it can either be inviting people around you or it can also be standoffish.
Yeah, and I think that's increasingly difficult to know how something will land in a society like ours where, you know, the religious landscape is just not what it was, even in recent memory and in the lifetime of people around today. And so something that might have not had that negative reaction, you know, 40 years ago does get that now.
Yeah.
And that's just a reality of the world we live in. I mean, for instance, this phrase, Jesus Duke, came around, I don't know, circa 2010, maybe. And it's hard to imagine that phrase sort of entering the lexicon, you know, maybe in 1990. I just think it wasn't sort of the same. It didn't feel as remarkable then, perhaps.
Right. So, like you say, maybe there's a generational dynamic. And it's interesting. I mean, so you make your living, your trade is as a writer. And, of course, you're diving deep into subjects that are often painful, broken, sometimes bordering on the horrific. So the idea of a Jesus juke, I mean, it's before you. Maybe sooner rather than later, you will use that and become that in your own personal life and even more so in your writing. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of the impetus for writing this reflection was thinking about particularly some books I've been reviewing recently that aren't coming at things from a Christian perspective. And often they have very good, very thought-provoking, very fascinating ideas. But there are also cases where, especially, you know, at the end of the book, when it gets around to like, all right, what are the solutions for the problems we've now explored? Often I sort of lean on like, oh, that's it. That's the only idea you had. That does not seem great. and sometimes then, and sometimes at the end of other articles, you know, the answer I want to go to is like, well, I mean, could we talk about Jesus? but of course, it feels like a juke, right? It feels like I'm bringing Jesus into a conversation where that's not what people are considering and it's maybe not going to be received well. But the impulse is there because the other answers are so unsatisfactory.
Right. Okay, so we're watching, both Kath and I streamed Mayor of Easttown, which is a Kate Winslet HBO series. It's only 8 episodes. And so I started to watch it. I told Kath about it. Mm-hmm. So our conversation as you go through quickly the 8 episodes is there's Jesus all over this. I mean, it's hard to deny it.
Yeah, but then as we say that, it's a story of incredibly immoral people.
Right.
Top to
there's
bottom.
There's a lot of brutality.
There's so
violence.
Much brutality. There's terrible language. There's, you know, sexual situations that are totally inappropriate. So then someone could say, could Jesus juke us and say, well, how are you really? You're saying you see God all over this thing that's filled with immorality.
But at a certain point, and of course, it's for us and me at a certain age, it's easier to see that in this broken and horrific world.
It's such a beautiful portrayal of change and redemption. But again,
it's perspective.
It's perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens, and maybe this, you know, maybe this is part of the generational dynamic, and maybe people of my age will age into the habit. But I think, you know, at a certain point, looking at whether it's in fiction like that or in the real world, these very broken situations, on the one hand, and especially in my line of work, your mind can go to, okay, like what are the pragmatic things that we can do, maybe policy, maybe individually to help address these problems. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, I think at a certain point, it's like, well, you know, Jesus could come back. That would be another way, a little bit of an easier way. And in that it wouldn't rely on our strength and on the difficult practicalities of changing things through politics and through hard work. Yeah, I think that's where the impulse starts to bubble up.
Yeah. So as they say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. So there's a strong Jesus juke in your future, Bonnie.
Maybe. I don't think that I'll ever reach
That level.
My mom's elite level, yeah.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. This probably is going to be our last question. Is there's a way to do a Jesus juke? Like you mentioned the first one at the beginning. Well, you know, you could have spent 8 hours instead of watching Mayor of Easttown, or what is it? Easttown?
Yeah. Easttown.
Yeah. Yeah, that John and I did. You could have been reading your Bible. And there's no appropriate way to respond to that statement. But yeah. What?
Like, I mean, yeah, I guess I yeah. could have.
Convicted.
Right. But what about if, you know, if something comes into your head, like the thing you were reading, like, boy, you're considering a complex problem. You're proposing a solution that doesn't seem to really have any possibility of success. What about Jesus? What if you could engage your faith with a question to a person as opposed to a statement? Why, you know, you could have X, Y, and Z. Does faith ever enter into your thought process? Or would faith be something that could be injected into this to give us a different perspective? Or like, is it different how you ask the question?
Yeah, I think so. I think coming with a question rather than an announcement makes a difference. And I also think that the nature of the topic at hand makes a big difference. How serious is it? How likely is someone to consider sort of like that ultimate level solution, right? There are like contexts where someone is doing a Jesus juke and it just feels silly and it's hard to take that well. But there are other contexts where even if the other person isn't going to end up agreeing, maybe it's easier for them to understand why, you know, a Christian's mind would go there and why they would want to talk about that and bring that up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it depends on context a lot. And I think, for me, at least, I think a Jesus juke was not the move. I do try to practice patience and remember, the good reasons why someone would go there.
That's good. Bonnie Christian's with us. Hey, Bonnie, before you leave us, tell our audience about your Substack.
Sure. You can find me at bonniechristian.substack.com. That is Christian like Jesus, but it is spelled with a K, K-R-I-S-T-I-A-N. So sneaks up on you a little bit there. You don't know immediately that it's going to be a juke.
It's a subversive juke is what it is.
Yeah.
Always a pleasure, Bonnie.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Bonnie Christian, she's a columnist at CT, Christianity Today, deputy editor at The Week, author of A Flexible Faith, Rethinking What It Means to Follow Jesus Today. Bonnie Christian.
Does this make sense?
Does what make sense?
Drumsticks. No, I'm not talking about the actual musical instrument. I'm talking about those Nestle ice cream things. They're like an ice cream cone.
The Nutty Buddy.
It's kind of like a Nutty Buddy. Is it? Okay.
It's a cone.
Yes. Vanilla ice cream.
With a chocolate
on top.
And nuts.
Yes.
It's a Nutty Buddy.
Okay.
It makes 100,000%.
Yes.
I love...
Does that sense for you? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I love a Nutty Buddy. Mm-hmm. I mean, seriously. A Nutty Buddy is like as close to perfection as you're going to find.
Mm-hmm.
And easily available at any grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
It makes 100,000%. Yeah, I'm adamant about it. You're telling me it doesn't make sense?
No, you're telling you it does make sense.
Oh, gosh.
I'm telling you that perhaps it's a mixture of the spring-like weather, summer-like weather, and perhaps it's a mixture of me not having had sugar since January 21st.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on my mind.
Yeah,
I don't know why it's on my mind
no
so
sugar.
Much. Probably. That is totally artificial in every
doesn't
way
matter.
And yet completely delicious.
It's
why is it?
Delicious.
Why is it so magically good?
So when you break your sugar fast, that'll be there?
I don't know. I don't know.
I'm doing a chocolate chip cookie.
Okay, fine. There's just something about the, and I don't, people will say it's totally artificial. I acknowledge it. It's still great.
The Nutty Buddy
so
makes sense.
So good.
All right, does this make sense? As a fashion statement for men, the plain white tank top, commonly referred to as the wife beater. The plain white tank top. Now, here's the weather's nice. You're going to see guys walking around with the plain white tank top.
Yep.
And there it is. I mean,
absolutely.
At least nothing to the imagination.
Absolutely does not make sense.
What?
It's awful. It doesn't matter if you're in the best shape in the world. It's
really
no. It doesn't matter.
A tank top?
It is bad. No matter what. But no, a white beater is not necessarily a tank top. A special tank top has to be a white beater. It has to have. It has to be cut specifically low on the sides, so that a bit of the abdomen can be seen.
Maybe stained.
Right. Probably stained, and a little overwashed. You know that feeling that,
kind of
or a look that it gets where it's like, wow, that's really, yeah, you've had that a long time. It's such a gross depiction of the male person.
But when you see guys like, you know, working outside, doing your lawn.
Maybe that's
right?
Okay.
Cement guys.
Maybe it's,
know,
okay simply because you're working that hard.
Exactly.
But if you're going to a concert or something,
and you're wearing that,
you're coming over to my house for dinner, you're please don't do that.
Please do not.
Please do not do that.
But bring a nutty buddy.
But please, anytime.
I'm not a mathematician.
Mm-mm.
I'm grateful
neither.
That I can balance my checkbook, and that about is the extent of my math prowess. However, today is Pi Day, and mathematicians, nerds, people who ascend to a higher level of numbers than you and I, Kath, they celebrate this day with great gusto.
For sure.
Russell Howell is a professor of mathematics at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. He holds degrees in mathematics and computer science, co-editor and contributor to Mathematics in a Postmodern Age, a Christian Perspective, and Mathematics Through the Eyes of Faith. And Russell wrote a piece at Christianity Today, which we would love to delve into with him, called Food for Thought, The Theological Life of Pi. Russell, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and it's good to meet you for the first time.
You as well. Thank you.
Russell, you write that in 2016, Swiss mathematician and evangelical Christian Peter Trube, his computer spent 105 days calculating pi out to approximately 22.4 trillion digits on a much more humane level. But also very odd, I had a friend who, when he was a sophomore in college, decided to make a skit out of him giving all the digits of pi, and he took it out to like 264 digits and had them all memorized. So I guess my question for both of these people is, why would you do that?
Well, you know, I think the record is someone from India recited 70,000 digits of pi.
Oh my gosh.
Really? Recited by memory?
By memory, yes.
Wow.
So I can't even think in that universe, but partly it's out of intellectual curiosity, I suppose.
Yes.
Doesn't it seem really odd that this constant shows up? If you take the circumference of a circle and divide it by its diameter, you always get the same number, no matter how big or small the circle.
Right.
And
it's crazy.
The symbol pi didn't come up though till about 1700s. Created by a Welsh mathematician, peripheria, which means periphery. And he took the first letter of that, which is the Greek letter pi. Actually, the Greeks would say pi, but it's anglicized to pi.
So, Russell, as a mathematician, I mean, you're operating on a totally different level about the majesty and creativity of God than Kath and I, most of our audience, can even imagine. Can you go into that? I mean, a secular mathematician, and I'm sorry to put that in a, you know, in a box, thinks differently than you as a Christian mathematician.
Yes, although in some sense, the axioms of mathematics are worldviewishly neutral. So there is not a Pythagorean theorem just for Christians.
Sure,
right.
Sure.
A
theologian once nuanced the term noetic depravity to include effects that the fall had on our thinking. And Emil Brunner is his name, and he said that the closer something is to the center of man's existence, the more that has been affected by sin. And the farther it is away, the less affected. So he says it's meaningless to speak of a Christian mathematics. Now, I think on one level he's right. As I said, there's no Pythagorean theorem for Christians. I mean, if you agree to play the mathematical game, then you agree to play by the rules that comprise that game, which are the axioms and theorems that have been proven prior to that. But that's not to say that there can't be influences from the Christian faith to bear on the practices of mathematics, why you engage it, or even what the ontological status of mathematical objects is.
Hmm. Okay, before we even tackle any of that, I guess I want to ask you about how, is it weird to ask a mathematician how you feel about such a constant in the universe? I was reading an article today, I think it was in CBS News, about Pi, National Pi Day, and the mathematician that was cited there said he finds it chilling that no matter the size of the circle, that number is always the answer, no matter what the different values are in the question. And so how do you feel about that?
And it's not just that. It's that pi all of a sudden mysteriously surfaces in unexpected context. Hmm. If you take the bell-shaped curve, which is the basis for probability, the formula for that involves pi. Hmm. And why would that show up? Well, I think I have what I would call an Augustinian view of mathematical objects. I think that they are, well, let's back up a bit. I think mathematical truths are eternal and necessary and were true even before humans were around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Martin Gardner once quipped, if two dinosaurs met two dinosaurs 55 million years ago in a clearing, there'd be four dinosaurs there, even if there were no humans around and the dinosaurs were too dumb to count.
right.
So there are problems with that view, huge philosophical problems. If those truths are eternal and necessary, the eternal bit is odd because God created everything. And so how could something be eternal and necessary and not created by God? And also, if they're necessary, did God have a choice or not have a choice? Could God have made a world in which 2 + 2 does not equal 4?
Hmm.
Now, I should say that Christians disagree on that. So the view that I have is, no, God could not have made a world in which 2 + 2 does not equal 4. But that's not an infringement on God's omniscience. It's just an expression of God's nature. Just as it is impossible for God to lie, so too, it's impossible for God not to think logical thoughts. It's just by virtue of who he is. I am in awe because if that view is right, and you know, there are very serious Christian thinkers who don't hold that view, but if it is right, then we're playing around with the divine intellect in some sense and getting some insight into that.
Right. So then is it true that pi, is it mathematical perfection?
Is it true that pi is not mathematical perfection?
That it is mathematical perfection, that, you know, it is constant and true no matter what's presented before it in that circle, that it's always there.
Yes. I mean, that's my view, that it's an eternal and necessary truth. Now, how did, if God created all things and these are eternal, how does that jive with God's creating everything? Well, all one has to do is expand your definition of creation to include sustaining. So it's not like the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter equals pi at some point in the past didn't have any ontological existence and then it got ontological momentum. It would be that God has always thought those thoughts and he always has sustained them. Hmm. And so if you can think of creation as sustaining and doing that infinitely, you know, from time eternity, then I think the problem disappears.
Let me ask you for a minute, Russell, about your colleagues. You've been a mathematician for, I'm guessing, quite a while. And, you know, I, like John said, understand so little about mathematics, but I'm always, when I talk to a mathematician or a scientist, am just amazed at the observability of the universe and the constants that are there. And so I'm wondering what your, how perhaps colleagues, unbelieving colleagues you have would think, do these mathematical constants have any implications for their ideas of creation or the sustaining of the universe?
Good question. Mark Steiner, who is at least last I checked, a theologian at Hebrew University, did his doctoral dissertation at Harvard and wrote a book called The Applicability of Mathematics as a Theological Problem or as a Philosophical Problem. And he essentially says, look, if naturalism is true, then humans would have no privileged status in the scope of the universe. They would just have evolved with cogs in the machine and so on. Why is it that human aesthetic principles wind up being so successful in explaining how the universe works? And to unpack that a little bit, Brian Greene, in his book, The Elegant Universe, has even said, physicists have abandoned a raw naturalism and put symmetry on the pedestal of explanation. In other words, we look for things that are symmetric and pleasing, and then we make mistakes and it doesn't fit the data, but ultimately that is successful. That's Steiner's argument. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
Yeah. No, that does. That's certainly an answer to the question. It seems like a wonderful point of connection, since we all live in the same universe governed by the same laws and constants. Whether we believe or don't believe, we are common recipients of that grace. Yes?
Yeah, I think C.S. Lewis wrote, I forgot what book, but he says, the disorderly or complex world that we cannot endure to believe in is the same disorderly or complex world that God would not have endured to create. So if we are created in God's image, and I think we are, part of that image, I think, includes a rational capacity reflective of God's that enables us to enjoy and admire his creation. Now, I gotta make sure that not all Christians have that view. Most notably, George Berkeley, Bishop George Berkeley in the mid-18th century, was a nominalist. He did not believe in abstract ideas or objects. The recent contemporary, the philosopher William Lane Craig has that view. But there are also non-Christians that have my view. Penrose, for instance, the Oxford physicist, postulates the existence of a separate mathematical world of objects that somehow humans have access to. It's not clear to me how that is. I think it's much more appealing to say, well, we're created in God's image and we think his thoughts after him.
So then, to follow along, I mean, is mathematics the architecture of it all, the numbers combining together to create the problem where there is an answer to? Is that perfection?
Is mathematics perfection? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by perfection. I would not want to ascribe a moral status to the Pythagorean theorem, for instance. But it's perfect in the sense that it's eternally true. It's true in every conceivable world. By the way, if mathematics is just a human construct, why is it that ancient China, which was, now there were trade routes and so on, but mathematically they were virtually isolated from the rest of the world. But they have a whole, there's a whole long list of results that were discovered by the Chinese and also by people in the West. I could list them, but the binomial theorem, the solution of nth roots of polynomial equations by Horner's method, the earliest use of negative numbers, combinatorial analysis, Gaussian elimination for the solution of systems of linear equations, and so on and so on. So you could say, well, that's because our brains are the same and we evolved that way. I think it's a better view to say, no, our brains are the same, yes, but it's because we were created that way. Mm-hmm. By God. Same thoughts.
And we're observing the same universe.
Yes. Yeah, good point.
Well, it's absolutely fascinating.
Russell, thanks.
Thank you for bearing with people
who are so ignorant.
I heard your conversation just before I joined. Let me say a pet peeve where I think it was John saying, I can't barely balance a checkbook or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yes, sir.
I can't do math. John, that's arithmetic. So when people say do the math, I cringe because that's not do the math. That's do the arithmetic. Mathematics is working with symbolic logic and things like that.
Yes. But,
okay.
Interesting. Maybe
you,
in a future
Russell.
Time you can
the
break that down for us.
And
if you could come back and discipline John more, I think that'd be helpful as well.
Good. Russell, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Our pleasure. Russell Howe, professor of mathematics at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. He is a contributor to Mathematics in a Postmodern Age, a Christian Perspective, and Mathematics Through the Eyes of Faith. Russell Howe, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A newborn fox recently delivered to a wildlife center could see an unusual sight when the fox grows old enough to open her eyes. A human caregiver dressed as a fox. Staff at the Richmond Wildlife Center in Virginia adopted the strategy as part of an effort to prevent the animal from over-associating with humans, the center said. A video showed a staff member bottle-feeding the tiny creature while wearing gloves and a red, furry, pointed mask to cover the human face. Quote, "It's important to make sure that the orphans that are raised in captivity do not become imprinted upon or habituated to humans," end quote, the post said, adding that the mask meant, quote, "she doesn't see a human face when feeding." I'm reading from today's Washington Post. "This is critically important if we're going to see her get wild." Other precautions include minimizing human sounds and handling and providing the kit with a snuggly toy fox to mimic the sensation of her mother. Isn't that cool?
First of all, the fact that people thought of that is so lovely. It is. It shows so much concern for an animal.
Yeah.
But let me ask you this. I know nothing about foxes, but I would think that animals would be more motivated by smell.
That's exactly it. Okay, so in this article in today's Washington Post, they say they talked to other animal experts and they say this is the first time we've seen someone dress as a fox. Now, you may have seen the videos a couple of years ago where workers at a zoo in China dressed in full body panda suits to take care of orphan pandas.
Okay, no, I did not see that.
But they're saying generally mammals, of which a fox is, they rely on scent, smell. But there's no harm done here
right. In
introducing this kind of contact. Right. Now, the best thing to do when coming across an injured or otherwise vulnerable-looking animal in the wild
is to don a fox suit.
No, is to use an app. An app called Animal Help Now, which helps users in the United States find the closest rehab center and provides location-specific resources.
Okay.
Animal Help Now.
Okay. All right. Well, that's very cool.
You ever find an animal when you were a kid? Injured?
I never did.
I did.
Oh, that would break my heart.
That's exactly it.
My kids were little, I was like, Lord, please send injured animals to another house.
A couple times I found birds when I was a kid, you know, that were kicked out of the nest. I would bring them home. You know,
can you
of course,
do anything?
Nothing.
No.
They
and
died.
All you, oh, that's awful.
It was horrible.
That's terrible.
Break your little heart, you know, but you're trying to help out and you felt helpless.
That's really terrible.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to celebrity birthdays, and who doesn't want to hit on the really important stuff?
Yeah.
I've got two today, John, for you.
Okay.
From very different parts of reality.
Okay.
First, I'm going to give you Simone Biles.
Who's Simone Biles?
She's the Olympian.
Oh, right.
She's the Olympian who backed out of the Olympics in the last Summer Olympics, saying that she had some... Mental health struggles. Right,
okay.
Right. She also has had back issues in the past. You're right about that.
Simone Biles is 34.
She is not. She's 27,
oh,
John.
Oh, jeez. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right.
I would also like to offer up Michael Caine to you for consideration
today.
Oh,
Michael Caine, one of the greats.
Yeah. When you think of a movie involving Michael Caine,
The Crown Affair.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Crown Affair.
Yep.
Got it.
Yeah.
Faye Dunaway in that?
I believe so.
I think so.
Yeah. Michael Caine, an oldie but a goodie. Mm-hmm. He is 82.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
He's 91.
Whoa. Michael Caine.
I was shocked by that.
I am shocked by that. Hold on, I totally missed that.
I really was.
91.
I mean, I'm not surprised that you weren't read up on Simone Biles.
Yeah.
Simone Biles, but I was very surprised that he was 91 years old.
I saw a clip recently. You know how I get you online. I saw a clip recently of Michael Caine discussing his drinking days.
Okay.
And as a young actor in the National Theatre of England, you know, all the greats, and according to Michael Caine, were just out of their minds.
They were
just first-rate alcoholics. And he, you know, he said it was kind of like a retrospective, looking back, how did we perform at such a high level, or what we thought was a high level?
Right, and being still that messed up.
Right, exactly. Because there you are. I mean, every night you're, you know, Henry VIII or Macbeth or
I know.
Whatever.
How could you possibly carry that out?
I have no idea.
Michael Caine received 2 Academy Awards for Best Supporting Actor, his role as Elliot in Woody Allen's Hannah and Her Sisters, and Dr. Wilbert Larch in The Cider House Rules.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm. How about Alfie, right?
Oh, yeah. He was also nominated for an Oscar there. Also, Sleuth, Educating Rita, The Quiet
Educating
American.
Educating Rita. That's an excellent film as well. One of the greats. Michael Caine, happy birthday.
The Ride Home with John and Kathy. A production of Salem Media Group.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.